Hi, everybody. Welcome to the live fundraising success webinar, Pulling It All Together, a lively discussion on direct mail's part in a multi-channel fundraising strategy, sponsored by CVS Global. I'm Margaret Battistelli-Gardner, Editor-in-Chief of Fundraising Success, and your host for today's event. Usually, I'm the moderator for these webinars, but today, I am very happily turning this over to our special moderator, Charlie Cadigan. More about him and our other guests in a minute. Today, our panel is going to tackle what have become the age-old questions. Is direct mail dead? How do we make it work with all the other fundraising channels we're usually using, especially the newer stuff like email, our website, and social media? But before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Ask a Question box. You can also use the Ask a Question box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions throughout and at the end of the hour. You can send them in at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so you can utilize all of the widgets and bells and whistles on this console. And speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on the console can do and how you can customize your experience today. Like I said, our moderator today is Charlie Cadigan. Charlie has spent his career designing strategies to help nonprofit organizations acquire, retain, and upgrade. He's a master of marketing integration. Charlie is a consultant at True Givers, a company founded by Roger Craver to help organize their donors' employer matching gifts. Today's panel consists of Karen Kirchhoff, Steve Curley, and Angie Moore. So, Charlie, why don't you take over now and make the more formal introductions?
Thanks, Margaret. Good afternoon, everyone, and good morning to some. It's my pleasure to be with you all today, and we've got a very timely subject that a lot of people are wrestling with in terms of how to present it to their boards, to their colleagues, to people they're mentoring. There's just a tremendous amount of interest in channel integration and what that means. I've got a great panel with me today, and before we begin on introductions, I just want to mention a couple things. We're going to be talking at varying degrees of levels with lots of professional we've avoided the professional jargon as much as possible, so we want to make sure that we get your questions and answer them as accurately as possible and as quickly as possible. So, but first, joining me today is Karen Kirchhoff, and Karen is Vice President of Mindset Direct. She has a long and distinguished career in direct response fundraising and channel integration. She's worked with some of the this country's largest and most prestigious clients. She's a frequent speaker in our industry, and if you've been to one of the trade shows, you probably have heard Karen speak. With each of our speakers, a more detailed bio is available, so please take a moment and click on that. Following Karen will be Angie Moore, and Angie is a senior executive with 25 years of experience. She is a C-suite consultant with broad experience. She has you can follow her on her blog, Fundraising Success, Navigating Off the Napkin, discussing the changes needed in the industry and how to take action on those changes. The last person that's going to share some case studies is a good friend and colleague, Steve Curley, with PETA Foundation, and Steve has had a fabulous career on both sides of the agency and on the nonprofit, knows the industry and practices extraordinarily well. His background covers everything from list to telemarketing. He's just got a great wealth of information and has some really fabulous results to share. So with that, what I'd like to do is to go ahead and ask Karen Kirchhoff to kick us off and take us through.
Great. Thank you so much, Charlie, and good afternoon or good morning to those of you fortunate enough to be on the West Coast and experiencing what I hope is a sunshiny day. So by show of hands, and I guess you guys didn't know we installed cameras in all your offices, but by show of hands, how many of you have heard your senior leadership, or your board, the folks that you are accountable to say something like, why can't we just send email? Why do we need this expensive direct mail medium? Anybody heard that? I'm gonna guess that all of you have your hands in the air, and not doing jazz hands necessarily. So, you know, I think there's some good, as we start talking about this conversation, I think there's some good stats to be aware of. Some of these I think are useful to jot down. I think that particularly if you're having these conversations with leadership, there's a lot of value in understanding how male plays a role in fundraising anymore. First and foremost, male is still responsible for the vast majority of revenue that nearly every single nonprofit organization out there is fortunate enough to receive. For most organizations, there's a handful that I think have really well-developed online fundraising programs or event-based programs, but 95% or more of revenue for most organizations is going to still be coming in through the mail. But having said that, I think it's critical for all of us to understand how digital, specifically digital in this next bullet point, really plays a role. Campbell Rinker did a study a number of years ago. Some of you may have read it. 37% of donors who give online say that they were prompted by a direct mail piece from a charity to go online, visit that charity's website, and make the contribution. Probably not surprisingly, that number jumps up to 50% for Gen X and Gen Y donors. So it's, I think, critical for us to understand this role that the Internet plays in fundraising and securing the gift. In addition, a donor who provides you with his or her email address is, you know, can be $15 to even $50 more valuable than a donor who does not provide you with his or her email address. I think the tip there is we ought to be asking everywhere we can, reply devices, telemarketing calls, if you're in an event, so on and so forth. And lastly, you know, this mobile channel, the kind of sexy mobile channel that's out there, everybody wants to do texting now. Text to give, make sure your pages are mobile optimized, you know, all those key phrases that we hear. But, you know, along the same lines as somebody who provides you with their email address, a donor who provides you with their mobile phone number, I've seen some studies that suggest that donor is worth 50% and even more than a donor who does not provide you with that information. This data collection element is important, and it's particularly important when we think about how all of these channels play together. So you might say, well, what does that mean? You know, so we've got all this data. We know that these donors are more valuable. We're doing what we can to collect this information. How does that impact fundraising? How are we actually going to generate more revenue? How do we use that to prove direct mail isn't dead? At Mindset, we really strive to use data to develop our clients' fundraising programs. And following the data is probably the first kind of that first and foremost strategy that you really should be considering as you're developing these programs, as you're being accountable to your boards and your senior leadership. Dedicated URLs, you know, some of the stuff is kind of no-brainers, but following the data and matching this information back is really where the value comes into play. So, for organizations that we've had the opportunity to work with, that revenue from dedicated URLs can range anywhere from, 1% of gifts that we can demonstrate are driven by direct mail if we're using a dedicated direct mail URL. And what I mean by that is, organization, www.nameofyourorganization.org/renew for your renewal series, or /donate for your appeal series, or /join in your acquisition program. You might even have dedicated URLs that are associated with particular campaigns. You know, if it's a year-end campaign, maybe you're using /year-end, things along those lines. So, I mean, we have seen, 1%, we've seen as much as 15% come into those dedicated URLs. We all know that there's lots and lots of donors who aren't going to use that dedicated URL for whatever reason. And in some exercises where we have matched back online giving to an acquisition list during a window where acquisition was in market, for a long time I never saw that number much above about 5%. We conducted this analysis recently for one of our clients and were able to attribute 17% of gifts in that window back to those direct mail lists. And frankly, what that allowed us to do was to reconsider some lists that appeared on the surface to be marginal lists, meaning they didn't quite make the cut in terms of response rate, maybe in terms of average gift, but when we folded those online gifts into the mix, they really proved to be a much more valuable list. And so it takes a little bit of work to get there. If you're doing external acquisition and you're working with a merge purge shop, You might be able to fold it in with one of your merges, so you don't run into minimums in terms of the fees associated with doing that analysis. But particularly if you're getting these questions about, well, why should we continue doing direct mail? I think it's important to understand holistically how donors are interacting with your organization. So who's on Facebook, right? I mean, probably, most of us on this call today are using Facebook or using Twitter. And I think everybody, who isn't necessarily in the weeds in direct response fundraising the way we are is saying, well, if we can't email, why don't we just, talk to people on Facebook? There might be something there. We've seen a couple of organizations start to figure out how to use social media and tie it back to mail, whether it's an offer of a free sticker, a free magazine, or a newsletter, perhaps a ringtone, for folks who are doing a lot of work in the mobile space. There may be something there, and I tend to be a fan of playing in these mediums. I'm not sure that I would ever recommend dedicating resources to these channels, mostly because I don't think you're going to see a lot of revenue from it. But in some cases, particularly on these free offers as, name collection strategy, we put those into direct mail acquisition or even, sometimes into renewal strategies and have been able to eke out, a decent response rate and start working on converting some of those folks from non-donors into donors or using that as a channel to help support renewals, for example, or your year-end campaign, for example. And last but not least, my favorite channel, telemarketing, who lots and lots of folks consider to be the ugly redheaded stepchild of our industry. And as somebody who grew up in telemarketing and really sort of got my start in running call centers and kind of on the floor as a caller, I tend to be a really, really big fan of telemarketing. I think when lots of us get into talking about multi-channel, we forget that multi-channel existed way back in the 70s and the 80s and so forth when direct response really was getting its legs under it. Online obviously makes this multi-channel equation a lot more complicated, but telemarketing is still there, and if it's used strategically, it can still be really, really effective. The one example that we've got up here is in using telemarketing to convert online activists. We have done these types of programs a number of times and have had really varying degrees of success, but generally speaking, there's been success. A recent campaign that we had up using telemarketing to convert non-donor online activists to monthly donors, right? So these are folks who had never made a gift but had taken action or, signed up for an e-newsletter, that kind of thing. We were able to convert more than 7% of them to sustainers on this call. Now, in the same campaign, we also had recent donors in the mix. And the recent donors converted to sustainers at about a third of that rate. So just almost 2.5%. To be fair, I don't typically see that. Usually it's in reverse. Usually the donors convert a little bit better, but the online activists are still a valuable audience to have in the mix. I think that telemarketing can play this really critical role as you think about these multi-channel elements of your direct response campaign. And so with that, I think Angie was going to talk with us some about, or Charlie is going to introduce Angie. Sorry. Thanks, guys.
Great. Thanks, Karen. A couple comments just to make based on Karen's presentation is that really the direct mail is the media that's going to continue to carry the water on an appeal to be able to really explain. I mean, nothing is a substitute or very few things can substitute maybe DRTV, but the ability to have two pages of copy to be able to explain the organization, to be able to explain the appeal. And for every organization that's on today, you're really trying to figure out really what channel mix is right for you. I mean, you've got DRTV, email, mobile, direct marketing, and as Karen mentioned, telemarketing. So it's really an understanding for everyone as to what that looks like for your org. So it's very difficult to port what works well for one organization and say, I'm going to take that and work with it. So the comment to make about an observation that Chuck Longfield made. Chuck Longfield, who was the pioneered Team Approach, a software system that's, really throughout our industry has been embraced by many organizations. He made the observation a couple of years ago that people that call to change their address are exponentially more valuable to an organization. In fact, he argues they probably are excellent candidates for major in-plan gifts. So just a tidbit to share with you, but to your point earlier.
Talk about data collection. I think that's right on.
Exactly. Okay, let's move on to Angie Moore. Angie is she spent 14 years leading the marketing, fundraising, and CRM for two nationwide charities, so she really has a great perspective. So, Angie, why don't you take it?
Perfect. Thanks a lot. You know, coming off of hearing you guys talk about whether, you know, how important data is and what you're supposed to collect, you know, I want to tell you that I'm hoping not to give you an afternoon nap here as I spend a couple of minutes talking about models. One of the things I chose this headline specifically, can models help build relationships? And I use the dreaded relationships word because I think our industry is evolving, and that's why we're here talking about multi-channel marketing and multi-channel fundraising, because people are moving around with our brands. They're doing different things. They're engaging in different ways. And we've typically thought of models in a single-channel way. And they certainly don't normally come to the top of your mind when you think about, you know, building relationships and really getting to know people. But I'm here to tell you that it's really not the case. And so, you know, I will say that, you know, I've had a chance to talk with a lot of people over the last couple of weeks just getting ready for this. Models are evolving just like the industry. Yes, it's true. You know, they've been around a long time. They've been successful, but they've also been more traditionally used in direct mail, and I would say on the other end of the pyramid in the major gift cultivation. But there's a ton of work that could be done in between, and I think all of our agencies out there and our analysts out there, and if you have them internal, if you have them external, if you're an organization, it doesn't matter. I think everybody is sort of realizing that, you know, now that people are moving across our organizations and you know, you just heard Karen talk about Facebook, telemarketing, online, direct mail, et cetera. Well, guess what? Those models are having to actually understand those different types of engagement and take that into consideration. It's also going back to the point about collecting the data. I'm going to make this point. Somebody's probably going to yell at me in the Q&A box. I think we have to be careful because we've all used RFM, so the concept of segmenting our donors in the more traditional way, looking at the recency of giving, the frequency of giving, and their monetary amount or the size of their donation has always been important. I absolutely believe that that can get in the way of good models. And the reason is it allows us to get a little lazy and not focus on collecting other kinds of data that's going to help us get what I call closer to the donor or closer to the constituent. So your RFM strategies, which we've all used for many, many, many years, they may work well, and that's great. Thumbs up. But don't let that be a crutch to not actually look for more information that can be used in a model or some of your segmentation strategies. So some of you probably saw my first slide on models and groaned because of just the word, you know, model. I you know, here's my point on this. Don't just be a modeler, or don't just say we've got a model. Really, the only reason you should be designing or developing or paying somebody to help you with a model is to help you answer questions or find solutions. So I put up some of the most common ones here. You know, how can I find more of the people that I want? And, you know, you'll see, I'm not going to read every one of these to you because you guys can look at it on the screen, but you'll see there's a little bit of a common thread here. A lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know what, our budgets are tight. You know, as nonprofits, you know, money doesn't grow on the trees. I hate to use a silly phrase like that, but, you know, there's a constant battle for budgets. So we're always trying to figure out a way that we can get closer to our market, whether it's a volunteer, a donor, an advocate, whatever it is, closer to our market without spending as much money as we did last year. And so models can help us answer some of those really tough questions, but we've got to make sure that we ask the question up front instead of just sort of, you know, willy-nilly going into the process. So on this slide here, I just want to put up a couple of points. And there's certainly not enough time in 8-10 minutes to talk about how models can help anybody's program. It's a much bigger conversation, but here are a couple of points to go through. They can help you get closer to knowing who your donors or your constituents are. And so at the very basic, even just looking at your own data, and even take the word model out of it and think of it from an analysis or a deep analysis perspective, they can help you build profiles looking at what you have in your database already so you can understand your constituents a little bit better. The second thing is you can go one step further. So you can sort of help complete that picture by using what I call external sources. So going to an organization or a company in the industry that has access to what I call third-party data, whether it's lifestyle variables, whether it's attitudinal information, and then, of course, you know, let's say you're trying to start a plan giving program and you don't have a plan giving program, so guess what? Or you have a recent plan giving program, so you don't have a lot of plan giving donors to actually look at and say, what's the profile of my plan giving donor? Well, guess what? You can even go and get industry profile information. Is it specific to you? No. But this is just to show that it's you don't have to be someone who's had years and years and years and years and years of a program to be able to then model after it. There's a lot of information in the industry. So my next point is, are you worried about not having enough data? If you're saying, I'm a small organization, I don't have a lot of donors, or, gosh, I really want to start this kind of program and I don't have anybody, so how am I supposed to model my donors if I don't have them yet in this area? Well, again, you've got these industry profiles, but on top of that, you've got a lot of options out there with third-party data based on those industry profiles that can sort of help you look at your donor base a little differently. You can learn from those industry profiles and then go back into your database and say, so who looks like this from a lifestyle perspective, whether it's a demographic piece, whether it's some other type of information. The other thing is that there are cooperative databases out there. And for those of you who may not have heard that term before, you know, think of companies that have sort of created a membership concept with nonprofits, and if you're a member of the co-op, then you actually put a lot of your donor information in there. It's anonymized, so it's not down to the Angie Moore level, and you know everything about me and where I've given, but at the same time, it creates a database of a series of tags or flags. So you can go to a cooperative database, try to be a part of it or actually create an arrangement with a cooperative database and get access to people that have those attributes, whether they are people who've given to health charities, whether they're people who've given to social causes, whether they've given to multiple, single, whatever it may be. And then last but not least, So I want to talk about this because everybody, and Karen, I'll reference something you said. You know, you started off and you said how many people have said, hey, can't we just do all this on email? You know, of course, everybody wants to see if they can model channel engagement. I'm not a modeler myself, but I'll repeat what someone said. Yes, you can do it, but it's really not the best approach you should follow because, as Karen also pointed out, and she gave us some stats, I think like 37%, and then in the younger generations, it's 50%. In the way people are making decisions, so I list engagement life cycle or customer decision journey, what we've learned is that people are using multiple channels as a part of what they consider as a single transaction. They might get a direct mail piece, they might go online, do a little investigation, and then while they're there, give a gift. But that direct mail piece was a critical part of their decision journey. So the reason you don't want to create a model to just go find online donors is because you need to understand that those online donors may actually have a heavy involvement in your direct mail program, and if you leave that aspect out, you're going to have a problem, or you're going to certainly miss some people. So I leave you with this pyramid, and you know, somebody will email me afterwards and say, my type of model didn't get on there. I realize this is not perfect, but what I've tried to basically say is, you know, guys, modeling is not for the bottom of the pyramid and the top of the pyramid like we've often seen in the past. You know, we've used all kinds of services to help us find major donors or the propensity to give, you know, big gifts, things like that. It's also not just to help us cut down on the mass numbers of constituents that we deal with at the bottom of the pyramid. There are lots of opportunities in the middle, whether it's a mid-level giving program, whether you're trying to identify potential sustainer donors. You can use it in events, you can use it in advocacy, et cetera. I think the biggest thing I want to tell you today is it's really about looking at the overall engagement and how these people are not just in one channel, but how they're looking at it across the entire brand. So that's it for me on modeling, and hopefully I didn't put anybody to sleep with that, and it just brings up some great discussion for you.
Great. Thanks, Angie. I think you really addressed it perfectly to the fact that everybody has heard a lot about modeling. There's many people perhaps in the audience today that, you know, are actively considering it or think that it's, you know, a silver bullet, and did a great job to kind of set it up perfectly for explaining it to the people attending and to a lot of other people that I'm sure are interested in it. Our last speaker is Steve Curley. Steve's a great professional and has had tremendous experience. Steve, you have a special announcement before you begin, so I'll let you go ahead and take that.
Excellent. So, hello, everyone. And the special announcement we have is we want to reward the early bird. So Kelly Bronson was our first person that dialed in and logged in from Whittier College. So we have a book for her. It's Forces for Good, The Six Practices of High-Impact Nonprofits. So, Kelly, make sure that we get your address, and we will send you that book. And that's a great example of how I'm trying to get an address from somebody to send them a prize so that I can market to them on many different levels in the future, which is what I'll go into now. So I'm with PETA. Just real quick, we're the largest animal rights organization in the world. We're about 33 years old. We have simple tenets. Animals are not ours to eat, wear, experiment on, use for entertainment, or abuse in any way. So as I go through my examples today, I wanted to give you three real case studies of what we've tried in integration. Integration and using all the channels is a big part of everything that we do, and it's, you know, we're making sure whenever we're coming up with a new campaign that we're thinking through all of the channels. So on our strategies, when we're sitting down to, you know, come up with a new direct mail appeal, we're asking ourselves, well, how does this play in social media? How does this play online? Is there an email component? Is there a mobile component? So that, and also, do we bring our marketing team to the table so that we address all of these issues? So what I'll do today is I'll walk through three of kind of the layering of some of the campaigns that we've done. And I will also try to, you know, I know that we have a certain amount of resources, and I know that there are different levels of organizations on the call today. So what, you know, my background, I came from a theater where I was the one person in the marketing and development team. So I know that, you know, sometimes you're working with very limited resources, and sometimes you have, you know, the ability to use many different techniques. So I'll try to address, you know, ways, real-world ways that I think you can use some of these. So the first one I'm going to outline is a technique that we used for conversion. So conversion would be, in my world, is trying to get somebody from taking some type of an action to becoming a donor. So we start out in the world of online, and I kind of just want to show you how we layer it together. So here you'll see we have a petition, we have a home page, everybody's got that. You know, you're driving people, you're always, always, always collecting email addresses where you can. We're also out there in Google Grant land with paid advertising, and then, of course, on Facebook with, you know, our different pledges. So, for instance, here we have a pledge to be vegan for 30 days, a pledge to be cruelty-free. Throughout all of this, I leave it really to our marketing team to go out there and collect and generate as many leads and many people as possible that are interested in these various areas. And as Angie was pointing out, you know, what we'll do with this is we source code these. So we'll give somebody that's coming in on pledge to be cruelty-free a code so that we know that an interest flag that they are interested in anti-vivisection work. So, you know, they're wanting to be cruelty-free because they don't believe in vivisection. So down the line, we know that we can target certain aspects of things to them, especially when we're spending money on direct mail. But I really want to point out here that, you know, for us, we have this opportunity to really, you know, affect people with a behavioral change, and that's great because that really ties them close to it. But all of us have something that makes us very unique, and the idea here is that you really find what makes you unique, and you pull that that thread through online direct mail, online telemarketing, whatever it might be. You keep that uniqueness going for you. So, you know, of course, when we put up a pledge like this, I'm hoping that our marketing team is trying to collect as much information as possible. So, you know, looking to make sure that we are getting full name and address. And, you know, most of the time there's a little bit of resistance there because they just want to get the person signing the pledge and then doing the next action on the website. to break that and have somebody give us their complete information is usually a bit of a challenge. So what we try to do is we will follow back up sometimes with an email to the people who just signed a pledge but didn't complete their address and offer them a free cruelty-free shopping guide that we would mail to them. And in this instance, it then connects us in a new channel with this person. But the next step then that we go to with this particular instance is we took all of our the people who signed all these pledges, and then we took the interest code for vivisection. And you see here we ended up sending out a postcard. So we didn't go with an expensive direct mail package. We stuck with something very simple. So anybody that signed the pledge for cruelty-free, the anti-vivisection work, we served them up this postcard, which asked them to take action by going online and signing a petition against the FDA. And in doing this, so they would go online to sign this petition, you know, it's inexpensive. The best thing about this is you can get right to market because you have these printed up ahead of time. So all you're really doing is lasering on the name and address, and you're getting it out the door so that they're connecting with you in their mailbox. So the next thing that we did is when they did click through to PETA.org/FDA, and I have to make a call out here on shortened URLs, I do the Ned test. So my father's name is Ned, and if I can't explain to my dad how to drive to a website under PETA's domain, I won't succeed outside of that. He's about 80 years old now, and I think that, you know, if I can explain to him on the phone, Dad, go to PETA.org/FDA, and he can do that, then I'm safe to use it. But if he can't do that and it's too confusing, then I make sure that we're not using something that's really long and complicated. And so from this then, you see people on that postcard were driven to this site where on the left-hand side they were asked to sign the petition against the FDA, and the next thing we served up then was a donation ask page, and we kept the branding, you can see the dog behind the bars there, throughout the entire piece. And at the end of the day, this particular technique for conversion actually did quite well for us, and we actually are able to bring our warm prospects in at about half the cost that we would with using a traditional direct mail package, which has all the pieces and all the components. Now, it's very targeted. We're using it as, only for the vivisection piece, but it is a new way for us that's less expensive and is proving itself well. So the next area that I wanted to show you would be a campaign that we would use to recruit monthly giving and using the different channels that we have at our disposal. So in this case, we start out the beginning of the year. We're a membership organization, so every January all of our members have to renew their membership. So at the same time, we're doing a recruitment to get people to sign up. So once somebody renews online or renews through the mail, the next piece they get from us is a request to, and it's through direct mail, they get a request to become a monthly donor. So they made their first gift, and then we asked them to become a monthly donor in the next piece, and it's a direct mail. So they might have joined online, they might have made a gift through the mail, but the next piece that they're going to get from us in this case is a direct mail piece. And in this, we're asking them to sign up to become a monthly donor. And then the next piece that we serve up after this is, actually, it's not a piece. We actually go to the phones. I have to point out that here, this piece right here, this direct mail piece, this is where about 40% of our monthly donors are sourced from. This is a big piece of our program here. So as we change and we do different techniques in, you know, layering integration, we don't want to do away with this piece. And this has its place, and it will always have its place until we test out of it. But I just wanted to point that out. So the next piece that we then go into is we put all of our new members and our renewed members on the phone. And so we're building upon the prior messages, and we are working with different telemarketing agencies. And in this, we're asking people to become a monthly donor. And in this call, we'll always reference back to whatever they received in the mail so that there's this building of the storyline. Now, you know, from my own mailbox experience, I know not all the time am I opening things, but at least on the outer I see something and it might trigger it. And we try to make that connection as we do the telefundraising scripts. Finally, once we're on the phones with people, we may have the opportunity to, the communicator isn't able to you know, get the person to sign up right then and there for a monthly giving, but there is an interest or there's a commitment, but just I don't give my credit card over the phone or, you know, some type of resistance that is normal, what we'll do at this point is we verify email address and we make sure that we know if they have an email address, is this the correct email address? I'll send you a reminder. Or if not, can I get an email address and we'll send you a reminder. And then what we do with that is the next day, the very next day, we actually send to the individual a communication using our own platform. So we don't let our telemarketing agencies send this on our behalf. We actually send it in our own platform. This way, when the user or the supporter clicks through, they're automatically logged in and it's seamless for them. We want to make this as seamless as possible. And I have to point out here, this is an interesting thing. As you go down the road of integrating and becoming very clever and you know, experimenting different things with multi-channel, you want to make sure you have your operations team at the table and your membership services team, the people that are on the front line, because they're the ones that are going to end up with these weird calls that you just didn't expect by, you know, making this one thing happen over here that, you know, these three things are going to pop up over here. And we learned the hard way with this one is that we had our telemarketing agency sending out the renewal, or I'm sorry, the click through to make your gift online, and we were inadvertently creating duplicate records. And I heard very fast from our operations team and our membership services that we had a problem. And so we corrected that, and we brought it in-house, and now we send it out. And I think that's always something that you want to keep and remain flexible with this. But, again, it's a great place to, at this point in time, to kind of close that deal. And the neat thing about doing this online with this follow-up message the very next day, we were able to increase our completion, our fulfillment of the fundraising ask by 20%. So that is a huge number, and I think that's something to definitely think about and write home about, is that, you know, if you're able to increase your fulfillment, that is closing that loop so that you don't have to send these people additional reminders, you don't have to, you know, send them two or three reminders like we do at sometimes, that you're able to close it, that's awesome.
Hi, Steve. It's Charlie. One quick question. How soon after the initial ask do you ask for the monthly gift?
Sure, that's a great question. So after after their first gift, it will be up to 2 to 3 weeks when they get their direct mail package. And in the meantime, we're also serving up, if they've made the gift online, we're serving up an email offer, and that usually hits within 2 weeks. So hopefully that makes sense. I think the one thing that's interesting with this is that you want to, you know, with integration, you want to lay out all of the different pieces. And it gets very complicated at times when you have different moving parts. But I think, you know, it's always that you're willing to try these different pieces and see what happens. You know, at times when somebody's looked at our program, they've considered it to be overcomplicated. You know, and so what we're trying to do in many ways is refine this so that it's not as complicated. But you know what, we're always kind of trying to figure out what is the right cadence for talking with people, and that's a challenge, and it always will be, I think. The next area that I want to go through is a typical house campaign. So looking at a house campaign, for those that aren't familiar with that term, it's just a special appeal where you're going out to your donors in the middle of the year, perhaps, and you have a very unique campaign that you're building that you want their support around. In this case, we try to, when we're doing a large house campaign, we try as best we can to leverage as many channels as possible and several times within a particular channel. So in this case, we had this story of University of Wisconsin and some testing that they are doing on animals, especially cats. And so what we were able to do is we went online first, and we really hit this, and we used all of our social media. We were in lead generation mode, so we were, you know, definitely collecting petition signers. When this broke, we, you know, in the first, I believe, 2 weeks, we had 200,000 signers. So it's really hitting hard at the very beginning to work with your marketing team to help you. If we tried to do this alone in development, we probably wouldn't have done as well as we did when marketing stepped to the plate and helped us. So, you know, we went out there, we immediately did this. The next thing that we did with all of the people who signed the petitions, or saw our ad on Facebook, is we served them up a series of messages. So in this series of messages, we had a three-part series. So we would send, you know, more information. We would send, you know, continue the story that we're telling them. about what's going on. And this was interesting because we tracked those people that had received direct mail, and that's my next slide I'll show you. But the people who had received the direct mail packages, their open rate online was 10 to 15% higher if they had received the direct mail package. So this is great, and you want to definitely, you know, make sure that you're layering these items in. The next slide then is the direct mail package. And on this, again, I did the NED test. I made sure that I could explain UW cruelty to him and he could find it. But on all of our direct mail, we branded it with this. So for more information, go here. Definitely, you know, we did two direct mail campaigns. So we had the first one and then the second one, and they just kept building on each other, and we got more and more prominence with the UW cruelty short code. So we were making sure that, you know, that got bigger and bigger. We didn't sacrifice any of our response rates for this, but for the direct mail package, but, you know, we definitely increased this piece of it. And then finally, when people did enter the UW cruelty, it took them to this slide, which was a donate now slide. Obviously, we're wanting to, you know, get them to do this. But at the same time, you know, we're big on engagement here. We need them to be doing additional things for us, and that is to take action. So the take action would take them to a page where they could send a petition to the university regions or a government agency, and then it drops them to a landing page for a donation. Also, it could take them to read more where they could go to the website feature that we had built around all of this. So, again, just this excellent layering effect. We had a much higher open rate with the people who had received the direct mail package. We also had the average gift of the people who had received the direct mail package and those online was 30% higher. So it definitely, for us, it shows that this layering will make it, is really important. The other thing we did with this page, since we had more than one option in addition to donate, we used remarketing in this effort. So making sure that anybody that landed on this page, we tagged them so that we could do remarketing with them later through Google platform. So I know I kind of raced there, but I hopefully kind of showed you some very practical ways that you can use, you know, all of your channels and really make it, you know, sing for you. So, Charlie, I think I'll turn it back over to you. I know I took a little bit longer.
No, you were great, Steve. Thank you. You made some great points on integration in terms of saving money. It's better for the donor. It's better for engagement, and that's, I think, a critical point. And we really have moved from a we make, you take to, you know, what media is going to work best for you and understanding what that looks like, you know, from a channel perspective. A couple questions that have come up, and I'd like Steve, I think actually the entire team here can look at these and help us answer. But the first one is, do you send a fulfillment or welcome package to new monthly donors online and offline, depending on how they signed up? Steve?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, as we were looking this last couple of years at, you know, tightening the belt on a lot of our efforts, we really looked at this because we thought, well, if they're coming online, why are we wasting money on direct mail? But we found that it does help and it does pay for itself to send them direct mail package. What we did cut from sending to our new joins from online is a welcome kit, and we turn that all into an online series. So usually in our welcome kit, it's a welcome letter. It contains a vegetarian starter kit. It also contains, you know, other ways to tap into PETA's resources. So we moved all of that into an online series for the online folks, but we kept this one package, which was a recruitment for monthly giving.
Steve, this is Karen. I think you're right on. I love this idea of the online welcome kit. I'll share a case study from an organization that I worked with a number of years ago and how we used welcome kit strategy and onboarding of new sustainers. It was honestly regardless of the channel they were sourced from. So if they came in online, they received the same welcome treatment as somebody who came in through telemarketing, for example. And it was, pardon me, a digitally printed welcome kit that included a certificate. It included some information on other opportunities to engage and give and so forth, but it also included a survey, which allowed us to collect, we've talked a couple of times about data collection. It allowed us to pick up a little bit more data on these really valuable donors, these monthly donors, and it also gave them, of course, an opportunity to make a donation. And the one-time gifts that came in off of this welcome kit actually covered the cost of the welcome kit, and we tracked the retention of the monthly donors after receiving the welcome kit, and it really drove their retention as well. So I think the notion of doing it online is fantastic. And as you pointed out, I wouldn't necessarily walk away from using some kind of welcoming or onboarding strategy in the offline, in the mail as well.
We have one question that I'd like everybody to really answer in a combined way, and that is we have a question about a small shop. They're really maxed out running the day-to-day, and how would we, on a tight budget and limited time, design and deploy such strategies as we've talked about?
This is Karen. I'll take the first crack at that. Having served on boards for relatively small organizations and worked with a number over the years as well, you know, I think, you know, honestly, you have to prioritize and figure out where the biggest bang for your buck is. I mean, that seems a little bit like a no-brainer. I would encourage you, and I would encourage, you know, generally speaking, small organizations not to forego direct mail entirely. Because it is such a pipeline for things like mid-level giving, for major gifts potentially if the donors are, you know, researched and cultivated, you know, based on, you know, a triggered gift, for example. Somebody who enters your organization with a $100 gift when you're only asking for $25 suggests that there's some additional value there and an additional level of passion and interest to your cause. And, you know, as sort of a follow-up to this pipeline notion, the vast majority of planned gifts are not, you know, of the major gift variety where they've been cultivated over the years. They're folks who have engaged with you through your direct response program and consider themselves part of the family and want to leave that legacy. And so I think there's a lot of value in direct mail, even if you are a small organization and trying to develop those strategies, even if they're just a handful of times a year, that not only help identify new supporters to the organization, but also continue to cultivate and engage those donors who have been with you and who you want to stay with you.
Great
yeah,
point.
Hey,
yeah,
Karen,
if I could just chime in here, Karen, that's great. I think that, you know, when I was back at the theater and we did, you know, our direct mail consisted of a season brochure once a year and a year-end letter. You know, this was, okay, I'm dating myself, this was some time ago, but had I been at that theater today, I mean, there's definitely you know, this opportunity to layer in, you know, Facebook, you know, targeted ads towards this audience, definitely an email message before and after, kind of cornering it. And there's a lot of great opportunities now, and it's just kind of creatively thinking about that. That's my two cents. Sorry.
No. And this is Angie. I'm not gonna dogpile here, but I do want to point out one thing. And I don't want to sound like somebody's you know, CEO or CFO who says, you know, hey, why can't you do all this online because it's cheaper. However, if you're a small shop, I do believe everything that Karen and Steve just said about having those critical direct mail touches or that, you know, something that a donor, a prospective donor can feel throughout the year in their hands is important. But even small shops tend to have some kind of web presence. And I'm not talking about Facebook and all that. I'm just literally talking about some kind of website. I would suggest from a real cost savings perspective that you try to leverage that as much as possible to if you're a small shop and you're building your donor base. I don't know if you're a small shop and how long you've been in existence, but if you're a small shop and you're building a certain type of donor base, don't ignore the online channel because that might be a way to get those people acclimated to that level of communication with you. Again, don't ignore the direct mail. It's still, you know, tried and true, but also look at some of those cost-saving efforts that you can do by creating that community online. Even if you're in horrors for all the analysts out there, they're going to hate me for saying this. Even if you're just doing it out of your corporate email address, you know, granted you won't get all the tracking done that we all like to talk about on webinars and things like that, but you're still going to be communicating.
One question that came up that I'd like, Angie, why don't you start with, and maybe Steve after that, is talking about engagement.
Yep.
A couple questions about, you know, how do we get donors more engaged? How do we interact with them? Maybe some of the tricks and techniques that are used to really stimulate those conversations to that can have value and yield some good collection of information about the individuals.
Yeah, so I'll kick us off here like you ask. You know, engagement's a really important word, I think, in our nonprofit vocabulary these days. You know, we used to think of engagement as people doing things that was non-financial, and I think we've sort of changed our feeling around that over the last 3 to 5 years, and really started thinking about the full process. You know, I don't mean to go back to the title of this webinar, but I'm going to. It's really about creating the opportunities across the multiple channels. Again, I think direct mail is always going to be a critical part of that. But you know what? Some of the online channels are easier to gather information, and people are used to giving certain information online. They're not used to giving it through direct mail. Online gives you the ability, forget about any kind of an ask or anything like that, but online is a great way to drive awareness around the mission and then follow it up with polls or surveys, things, but you've got to position it in a way where you say, we want to hear from you. So this is not about the charity gathering information so they can use it. It's really about saying, hey, look, we want your feedback. What do you think about our mission? How are we doing? Are we giving you the type of information you need? So I think if you allow yourself to think outside of just the asking component of engagement, you can bridge a new level of communication with people. And honestly, we've seen it in study after study. The more people are communicating back with us around these non-financial areas, it drives greater value in the fundraising area. So it's not that it's not worth the time, and it's not that it doesn't have an ROI. It may not have a direct ROI, but it's going to have an ROI in the long run.
Steve, could you just add maybe one or two quick points, because I want to move on to two other questions?
Sure. Yeah, no, Angie hit it head on, so that's great. I mean, I think as an activist organization, advocacy organization, we have the luxury of really asking people to do a lot of engagement with us. But we always have to remember that, yes, as we move into the online realm with a lot of these actions and things get really slick and smart with apps and things like that, that you will have your handful of very dedicated supporters who are not online. And if you stop serving them up petitions, pledges, surveys, like Angie said, you're going to miss this this opportunity to engage these folks who often are our best donors down the line. So just keep that in mind.
Great point. Great point. We've got time for about two, maybe three more questions. So let me grab one right now that just came in. I think it's an excellent question. I'm going to ask Karen to start, and then you guys can add to it. It's how do you define strategic fundraising goals in order to create a multi-channel campaign? So, Karen?
I think that's a great question. Goals are critical, and I think in this multi-channel world that we live in, there's a lot of gray area. And, you know, as fundraisers, as people who want to pay attention to the metrics, I think it's really important that we try to track those and not only establish the goals, but determine what's coming in on the back end. I think it's a little bit of a tightrope walk because I'm a big fan of thinking about multi-channel in the same notion that a rising tide lifts all boats, in that, you know, if you have, there's a significant amount of data out there around things, and DRTV is the best example. So if you think about direct response television, you know, the ASPCA, Sarah McLaughlin ads, or St. Jude's, or Operation Smile, I mean, any of these orgs that have really prolific direct response television programs, there's a lot of data that demonstrates the halo effect associated with those DRTV campaigns being in market and it influencing in a positive way direct mail and so forth. Steve talked a little bit about the remarketing that PETA has tried, which I think is like that's kind of the cool new shiny object in market right now that's out there that we can try to, you know, to use as follow-ups to direct mail campaigns. And I won't get into necessarily all the specifics of that because I am certainly not a remarketing expert. But establishing those goals and spreading the responsibility for driving those goals across all of the programs and all of the channels responsible for creating it. And what I mean by that are lots of organizations still have, unfortunately, still have silos between their kind of traditional offline direct mail telemarketing programs and their online programs where there is sometimes a marriage between the communications and sometimes there's fundraising as a part of it, but you know, often the fundraising on the online side isn't talking to the fundraising on the offline side and so on. So I'm a big believer in assigning revenue goals, especially across all of these channels and all of these opportunities so that compelling that integration between staff and compelling that integration between those channels, those revenue-generating channels, becomes more prolific. And over time, I think it, you know, as your organization collects data, because again, as Charlie has said, every organization is so different in how, you know, you think about a PETA where there's tremendous amounts of opportunities for constituents to engage with the organization in a non-financial way, and then there are organizations who don't have those opportunities. So, so the differences in how organizations are going to use channels is really important too. But if each of those channels have revenue goals assigned to them and the staff are kind of forced to interact and develop budgets together and develop campaigns and strategies together, that rising tide is indeed going to lift all those.
Okay.
Hey, Karen and Charlie, can I jump in here? I've got a quick add-on to what Karen has just said.
Okay.
So here's, you know, I'm looking at this question online, how do you define strategic fundraising goals? So here's what I would say. Everything that Karen just said, I believe 100%. The only thing I'm going to say is if you have only goals associated with the channels as a part of this multi-channel campaign, you're going to have a problem. So in the end, if you ask me how am I going to define these strategic goals, it's going to be at the constituent level. So the only reason you have a multi-channel campaign, whether it involves three channels or 12 channels, it doesn't really matter. It's because you're trying to get a certain group of people within your organization to behave a certain way. So the way you get up out of the departments and get up out of the silos is you orient those people. You know, I'm not talking about restructuring organization, but or budgeting or finance, but you orient those people around a common goal related to that group of people. So you say we're going to take segment A and we're going to deploy campaign XYZ and we're going to deploy it in these three channels. And by the way, whoever owns those channels, you're responsible for delivering the results. So you're going to have those channel specific goals. You know, you should know how much you're going to spend and what you're going to raise or how much you're going to get in a response, whatever the metric is, but that only exists to meet the constituent based goal. So my thought is, and not to repeat it, is just to say if you're going to go down the path of integration or multi-channel fundraising, you have to orient it around the group of people that you're trying to activate or change their behavior, not around the channel, not around the program, not even around the campaign, like a branding campaign or something. I mean, I will say this. You know, somebody made a comment earlier. I don't know, Charlie, if it was you or if it was Karen, but somebody said it in the very beginning and said, you know, hey, look, everybody's asking, is direct mail dead? And so since we're talking about sort of the multi-channel focus, I'll tell you, and I'll get some hate mail about this or hate email. You know what? If you're thinking of direct mail as a standalone program,
right.
Yeah, I think you ought to go plan the funeral. It's going to die.
Yeah.
If you're thinking of direct mail as a technique that is a part of an overall communication strategy, whether it's fundraising, volunteer raising, advocacy raising, whatever you're trying to do with that group of people that you're trying to activate across these multiple channels, then I think you got a long life for direct mail. So that's sort of my perspective on it, which is why I say you got to roll it up to the group of people you're trying to engage and make them behave a certain way.
Angie, you're getting a standing ovation on this end.
Yeah, I think there's really nothing else to say that can say it more succinctly and more perfectly. I'm going to turn it now, and we're also at the end of the webinar, so I'm going to turn it over to Margaret Battistelli to close us out and thank everyone for their time and attention. Some great questions. I'm sorry we weren't able to get to all of them, especially ones from my good friend at Heifer International, but we'll try to get to other questions offline if we can. Margaret?
Great. Thanks, everybody. And, Charlie, yes, we can get the questions that weren't answered and have you guys take a shot at answering them, and we can use that. We can present that in our Today in Fundraising e-newsletter, which is a free daily e-newsletter, and if you go to fundraisingsuccessmag.com, you can sign up for it for free. So we are actually just about out of time. I just wanted to thank everybody. I thought this was just a wonderful source of information, such a wealth of great information, and I can see from some of the comments from our attendees that they agree. So thank you very much to everyone who participated, and thank you CDS Global for sponsoring. Be sure to check out our webinar page at www.fundraisingsuccessmag.com to get information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars. And if you would just take a minute to fill out the brief feedback survey that should be appearing on your screen right now, we'd be very grateful. Your feedback will influence the webinars that we bring to you in the future. Thanks again, everybody. Thanks for participating. Thanks for attending. And I hope to see you all at the next Fundraising Success webinar. Thank you.